Welcome to episode 9 of the Over the Counter podcast. I'm Mark Eastrick.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
Today we're going to talk about urbanism and urban planning and other things connected with URPs or cities, which I have to confess I don't really know a whole lot about urbanism, and yet I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
I'm not an architect. I'm not an urban planner. I'm a theology and scripture guy. So urbanism is kind of like one of those things where I kind of like look over the fence at the architecture people. I'm like, that sounds really fascinating, but don't really know a whole lot about.
Okay, so we were talking during the break about it's placemaking, right? Okay, so what architecture or how to say it, like what design, like what furniture design and interior design is to architecture, and what architecture on a room level or kind of a floor level is to, say, like a big public space or like a church, that is to the overall neighborhood and to the city. When you take it outside of the walls and you're talking about the place that has buildings inside of it instead of furniture inside of it, we're into the world of like urbanism
now,
and urban planning.
There's some interesting things I can contribute from the theology and scriptural world to
right.
ideas of urbanism. So, I mean, it just makes me think back to the agora in the ancient Greek polis, right?
Absolutely.
This place where you come together with lots of other people, you buy stuff, you sell stuff, you talk, you converse, you have arguments, you vote, you know, that kind of thing.
The public
square, right? The Roman Forum in the city of Rome, right, which is surrounded by public buildings, religious buildings, the courts, the emperor, whatever else.
You said one of the big key words, at least the way I think of it.
Agora?
Polis.
Sure. But it's just the Greek word for city. Come on.
Right. Well, no, but when Aristotle says that we are a political animal, he says we are by nature the type of animal that lives in a polis. But for him, a polis is very clearly defined. It's not just – I mean, it's a city – it's a self-contained, self-supporting city-state. It's its own entity. And it's as – I think – how does he put it in the politics? I think he says something along the lines of, if a man stands on a podium, like on a platform – that's as high as a man, and everyone in the polis crowds around as close as they can to hear what he's saying, that man can see the end of the crowd in all four directions. That's how many people inhabit a polis, right?
See, okay, so, I mean, in a certain sense, I kind of like the idea, but I only like the idea insofar as what life looked like 2 or 3 or 4 or 5,000 years ago, or 100 years ago, at least.
Okay, but then this evolved. In what we have the classic European city, right? We have the classic urban life. And then when in early America, you see that being reflected in some of our cities, the way they're laid out. And they like when you go to like Cincinnati was put together, part of that was put together by people who there's a section called Over the Rhine because these Germans came and it looked like the Rhine and they built all this architecture and stuff. And so it feels kind of almost like a European city. And the main thing about the new urbanism and about this kind of the reclaiming of urbanism is the neighborhood. And the neighborhood has a core that's usually like mixed use. It has green spaces and stuff. It has neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods have clearly defined – the houses have clearly defined entries. They have sidewalks that you can walk, and I think that they define the new urban movement defines a neighborhood as this thing that's self-sustaining. It has you can shop, go to work, go to school, go to church, do everything you need to do, and you can walk from one side of it to the other, and I think it's 10-15 minutes.
Okay, so let me just throw out a couple things. So the idea of the polis as a self-contained city-state,
right.
I mean, unfortunately died a long time ago, or maybe fortunately. To me, it seems like modern cities are more like nodes on a giant network, right? Very interdependent, not independent.
But the question is, are they nodes within nodes? Is there nodes within those nodes? Is there neighborhoods? Are there clearly defined neighborhoods
No.
within those poles?
I don't think so.
And I think in some places there are. And I think you and I have talked about this before. I think a great way to talk about this is to I've said before we should do an entire podcast on the GI Bill, and we probably will at some point. But the invention of the automobile suburb,
right?
I mean, just changed everything.
Sure, sure.
Right, this idea that you would get in your car and you have to drive someplace to go buy some celery
or to go to church.
Look, there's a greater way for us to maybe approach this. You used to have a parish.
Right.
And the parish was where you were geographically located.
And everybody lived within walking distance.
Right. I go to Mother of God in Denver. It's 2 blocks from my house. Now, I've got a bad knee and a bad ankle, so I don't always walk down. But I could very easily, and I have.
So it's worth pointing out that, right, Catholics and other people used to live this way before the invention and proliferation of the automobile, that people lived within walking distance to most of the things they needed to go to in the course of a week.
And it's in the concept of
church
human
or school or work or whatever. But there is a community in the United States that still does this. Mm-hmm. Actually, a couple communities. The Jews do this.
Yeah.
Orthodox Jews and the Seventh-day Adventists.
Hmm.
I have some Seventh-day Adventist neighbors that walk to church on Saturday morning every week. In D.C., I had some Seventh-day Adventist neighbors that the Trader Joe's is in their neighborhood. So whenever I was going to Trader Joe's on a Saturday morning, they were all walking to church or walking back, you know. Jewish neighborhood also in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. It was kind of beautiful, right? Everybody walks to shul. Everybody walks to the synagogue every Saturday, every Friday night, every Saturday.
But, I mean, a good example that a lot of people have, let me back up. See, my fascination with this comes from two different things. On an intellectual level, it comes largely from my involvement with like coffee houses and neighborhood and old downtowns, being interested in that. But then my liberal education and the philosophy and theology of that got bound up in this by me reading Philip Bess's book, Till We've Built Jerusalem. And he's the head of the architecture department at Notre Dame, and he wrote a book called Till We've Built Jerusalem, which is he kind of straddles these worlds, and I found him kind of a kindred soul in this. So, but the other reason that I'm interested in this is because I've lived it and experienced it, and that is, and I think a lot of people will have an experience of this if they think about it, and that's the college town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I lived in Fort Collins is a classic downtown, classic new urbanism kind of core downtown. You can there's a whole definition of like the urban core, the neighborhood surrounding, the kind of bigger houses with bigger yards, and then farms, and then a green belt surrounding, and then the next one kicks in, right? And that's the idea of like the classic little city, the classic village, the classic polis.
Okay, so what's so unsatisfying to me about this conversation happening in 2014 is that to me it seems like the only way these little neighborhoods or whatever can be achieved is just totally artificial, totally concocted. It's not something natural. And what I mean by that is that...
And you certainly see that.
Is that... I mean, I've seen some of these like purpose-built communities and walkable communities that have been built and new urban centers and stuff like this.
And they're a sham. They're full of box stores and national chains. They have a little coffee house in the corner, but it's a Starbucks. And they have a place to grab a sandwich, but it's a Quiznos.
Not always. Sometimes they really try to go for like locally owned businesses or whatever. But all the businesses are retail-ish, right? They're all like restaurants and stuff. There's nothing that's not retail, which is bizarre because it's like... What percentage of actual businesses are retail businesses? Very, very – it's small, right?
Right.
It's not the majority. And it's always like young professionals without children, you know, and it's just like it's not like a natural community. And everybody owns a car, so they can drive out of it whenever they want and go to Walmart.
But you're talking about the people who live kind of in that mixed-use core. Okay, but then Fort Collins, Colorado is a perfect example. And in case my uncle's listening, I love Fort Collins. I used to say that all the time. He mocks me all the time. I love Fort Collins. I do. I love Fort Collins. It's a spectacular. I love college towns in general. Columbia, Missouri is another town that
I grew up in a college town.
Right. So look at Fort Collins. You've got along College Avenue, downtown, and then mountains crossing it, all those cross streets, and then Mason sandwiches it on one side. And I lived in that downtown core right behind the Aggie in an apartment. To say I didn't need to use my car is an understatement. I didn't need to use my bike. I worked, worshipped, shopped, exercised, D all the above, inside of the same six blocks. So, but then around that, you go outside of that urban core. You keep going down Mountain Avenue past St. Joseph's Church. You start getting to these houses side by side, but it's still a neighborhood, tree-lined, you know, street sidewalks, clear entrances to the houses, people walking and their dog and talking to each other. And then you get farther past that, maybe it gets a little more sparse. The houses are bigger, farms, greenbelt mountains, right? It's that strata. That's kind of anchored somehow in the middle.
Yeah. Well, see, this is, I mean, how do you put this? One of the things that the suburbia yeah. produced
yeah.
is these bizarre neighborhoods where everybody lives in a cul-de-sac.
Right, right. Oh, and, I hate that.
Right, yeah, where all houses are beige, everybody lives in a cul-de-sac, there are very strict rules about what you can and can't do with your property.
Right, right, right.
And the bizarre thing about living on a cul-de-sac is that there's no parking. So if you want to have friends over to the house, they have to park two or three streets away to walk over to your house because there's no parking on a cul-de-sac.
They go park in someone else's cul-de-sac.
Right, right, because you can only park, one car in a cul-de-sac. And the houses are large and the yards are small.
Right.
And maybe there are no sidewalks. And it's not a walkable kind of experience. And if you want to go to a store, if you want to go to a church, right. if you want to go to a school, you have to drive because those things are not in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I think we've kind of gotten off track and now you're bringing us back on. Because I'm not really kind of married to the new urban thing. I'm more interested in the modes in which people interact with each other and whether or not there are ways to make a more human interaction
right.
between them. I personally spend most of my time inside of a room designing that because as a coffee consultant, that's what I do. I build coffee houses for people. So I see, here's the shape of the room. How can I create this weird combination of privacy where you can be alone and read a book, but you can also bump into each other and have conversation, but that won't bother the person who's reading over here. I mean, so and then if you look at this, you and I both have a lot of experience with the thought around sacred architecture. Right. I mean, I can remember and it's the role space plays in that. Right. I remember when my alma mater, Thomas Aquinas College, was building Our Lady of the Most Holy Trinity, their new chapel. It's a classic cruciform chapel. Right. And the ratios of how high it is to how long it is. And it's, you know, if you look at it from above, it looks like a cross. I snuck past the scaffolding and all that and walked into the back of the chapel when it was still just absolute bare stone, nothing in it, right? Just a bunch of equipment. And it pulled me forward and up. It pulled me towards the tabernacle and strangely up at the same time because of the mathematical ratios, right?
Yeah.
They've designed that shape and those ratios to fulfill the end. I design a coffee house in a certain way to fulfill that end of that interaction. So when you're talking about a neighborhood or you're talking about a small city, you're talking about this interesting one. You're asking questions like, well, how is it best for people to live? What are we trying to get people to do? And is there a shape or a mode that is more effective at that?
Well, see, this is something that's really interesting because the people that make these decisions are often people on things like township boards right. and city councils who don't necessarily have any education in architecture, urban planning, or anything.
Right.
And you've got folks from architecture schools and development companies coming in, making proposals that are designed for profit and not for humanism.
Right.
And then the city councils or township boards voting on these things. So I think what ends up happening is that these boards or councils tend to want to overzone,
right?
And to define the use of a particular space or area too narrowly. So you get this bizarre thing where you've got a whole bunch of houses, right? And then a whole bunch of stores in another place,
right?
But there's no cross-pollination at all, right? Like the whole idea of like the neighborhood corner store, totally gone.
Right. And I grew up in a small town, and every neighborhood had the corner store.
Right.
I live in a neighborhood. The only thing
the
only thing that my neighborhood is missing right now, and I have literally thought about trying to design it, get some investors, and do it, is a little corner store.
Yeah.
That's kind of that deli meets coffee house meets general store meets,
right?
You know, you can.
And it used to be a feature of every neighborhood in the United States.
Right. I grew up in a town that had one of those, and we used to walk down. In fact, I have this scar, if you can see on a big scar on my right wrist, because my uncle, I was too little to walk by myself to the little, it was Matthew's Grocery, it was what it was called on Monroe Street in Deloge, Missouri. But we always called it the little store. And I wanted to walk to the little store by myself. And my grandpa, my great uncle, that was kind of like my grandpa, he raised my dad, he didn't want to let me walk by myself because I was too little. So I was walking on the sidewalk back from the store, the two blocks back to the house, and he was driving at 2 miles an hour in his old Rambler, watching me walk. And I was drinking a soda, and I slipped and fell on a crack in the concrete and slammed the soda bottle down. That's how I got the scar. But it's funny that every time I see this little scar, I'm kind of glad I have it, because it reminds me of this really what life was like when kids could still run around the neighborhood, and there was a little store down in the corner, and they all knew me. And if I was a quarter short trying to buy a soda, they'd just give me the soda. They'd tell my uncle when he came in, you know. Or, I mean, it's
small town life.
Yeah, it was. But small town life didn't used to only
your Norman Rockwell painting upbringing.
Right. Well, no, sir, it was certainly anything other than that. It was the 80s and 70s and 80s, and it was kind of a dark thing in some ways. But that being said,
Norman Rockwell with a Faustian twist.
Yeah, exactly. But that being said, is that people might have had that exact same experience in a neighborhood in Brooklyn growing up in the 60s or something like that, where it's like I've heard people talk about you did something wrong and it didn't even matter if it was your dad or anybody in your family. You would correct other people's children.
Yeah, okay. So
they knew everybody.
So it all ties into that concept of the neighborhood and having a space that's planned in a certain way, right, to create those kinds of human interactions.
Right.
So one of the things that I think has happened with suburbia that was unintentional, one of the unintentional consequences of it, is to rather than create community, to create isolation.
Absolutely.
Right? And I look at those giant beige houses in the suburbs and say, that's basically a big box in which you can watch TV.
Exactly.
Right. It's not a house in any kind of classic sense where it's built into a space that everybody is inhabiting together.
Mm-hmm.
It's an isolation chamber, right? It's designed to be like a hermetically sealed container for your family.
And that's why the cul-de-sac, right?
Right.
Because you don't want anybody driving by your house.
Exactly. Right. You don't want traffic. You don't want people walking by.
And so you have these bizarre neighborhoods that have all these little twists and all these cul-de-sacs, and none of the streets go through.
Right.
Because they want to discourage people cutting through.
Right.
So there's no traffic. They don't want people walking by your house, looking in your windows while you're trying to wash your dishes. So there's no sidewalks.
Right.
It's an isolation chamber. It's the atomization of the American family community.
Now, you know, it's like, I mean, I think that's led to a lot of problems.
Of course, yeah.
Socially speaking, whether it be families that don't have support, and whether it be divorce, whether it be mental illness, I think isolating ourselves contributes to a lot of social problems.
There was a really stark example of this just like last week. A woman had died. I think she might have killed herself because they found her dead in the back of her car in the garage. So it sounds like a suicide, leave the door closed, leave the car running kind of thing. So there's A, this person was isolated enough that they killed themselves. B, She'd been there for like a year and a half. Now, we hear about these things.
You sure it was a year and a half? I think I heard the same story.
Okay, maybe it was
quite that long.
Okay, maybe it was 6 months to a year. It was a long time. It wasn't until they went to repossess the house that they found her, because that was the one thing that wasn't set up on auto withdrawal. Because all of her digital self had been, her Netflix had been paid, car insurance was paid.
Okay.
There were all these financial transactions that say
that's insane.
That she's alive and active. If you were looking at her, if you were a detective and you pulled the bank records, you go, well, she's been paying her bills on time.
So
this, she was dead the whole time.
So this is, I mean, this is sad that there are two stories like this. The story that I had heard was different, that there was a woman who is found in a car at DIA, at Denver International Airport.
Wow.
And the car had been there for some time, for like a few weeks or a month or two.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, people probably looked over and said, oh, there's somebody sleeping in that car, whatever. But then eventually it turned out she wasn't sleeping, right? And I think she had taken her own life or something. But
so these people are so – they're so isolated – that no one
one even notices.
So so it's the hardest on the poor or on the elderly, or especially that, because they have no one to reach out to them. If you live in, I mean, there's a good argument for a city like Vienna, for instance, is a city of apartment dwellers, and they, if you entertain, you entertain in public. This goes back to our restaurant podcast that we our scratch one that we didn't use, right, which we may put one up sometime. Or redo. But in Vienna, like in a city like Vienna, or you would, someone, hey, come over for dinner. And then they come over, you maybe have a cocktail or something. And then you all go out and you go to a cafe.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what you were talking about in China, that you would go over to this restaurant, you'd have a private dining room, but this person was picking all the food out and paying for it.
Right.
They're basically replacing the house staff that a rich person would have had, right? Well, this idea of public life, of living in public, is something that is very much part and parcel of urbanism, and that in the classical urbanism. And so, like, if I want to read a book, do I always hunker down in my room by myself? Do I sit on my porch and read? Or do you take a book and a notebook and maybe your dog and walk down to the corner, and there's a place to tie him up outside and some water to drink, and you drink and you read a book, but you're going to read because you want to be interrupted a little bit. You want to see the same people.
This is important, right? Because I think that Americans have shifted from living in public to living in private.
Absolutely.
And that there's something really dangerous about this. So I think that one of the easiest illustrations of this is that older American houses, so houses 100 years old, whatever, have front porches.
Mm-hmm.
New American houses have back decks.
Right.
Okay, so it used
to
be...
That is such a great distinction.
It used to be...
I've never thought of that. That's amazing.
You hung out on the front porch and sipped your iced tea and said hello to the neighbors walking by and whatever else. The kids played in the front yard. But now you sit out on your back deck. You invite over your private friends.
Right.
You don't know your neighbors. So you put up some sort of screen on your deck so you don't have to look at them. They don't have to look at you while you're sitting there. And you have your own private party or your own private dinner, and your kids play in the backyard.
You know, and it's funny because I live in an old house that has a big, good-sized front porch on it.
Yeah.
But we also, they've added a deck.
Yeah.
So we've got a deck. And so when I want to read and be left alone, I catch myself going to the deck. If I want to read, but maybe just kind of people watch, because we have a lot of walk by.
Yeah.
We live off the edge of a nice urban corridor where there's a lot of bars and cafes and stuff. And so people walk by our house to get the three blocks over to the urban corridor. And so it's fun to people watch and say hi to your neighbors and hi to people walking their dogs. And so it's funny, I hadn't experienced that in a long time. And when I moved to this neighborhood last year in Denver, I used to really like to come home from work in the afternoon. And instead of retreating to my room, I would get whatever book I'm reading, pour myself a glass of white wine, go sit on the front porch, sip my wine and read my book, and random people would come by and chat with you. And I've got a great story about that. My friend and I Perry, that works in our coffee house here, he was over and we're sitting on the front porch. I hope this poor woman doesn't listen to this podcast. And this woman comes by, and she's got this dog that's real friendly, and she walks by the porch. We wave at her and say hi. And here's her playing guitar, and I'm drinking wine. And She turns around and comes back and brings the dog up to the edge of the porch. And she says, "Hey, would you mind saying hi to him? He has high social needs." She brought her dog back for us to pet because the vet said that he has high social needs.
That's awesome.
He needs to be petted by X amount of strangers a day or something. The dog was super cool. The dog, I felt sorry for the dog. I'm like, hey, what's up, buddy? We play with the dog.
So I guess one of the things that I would advocate for or hope for from our urban planners and city councils and whoever else is a less draconian zoning so that there can be a little bit more interplay. I've never been to Houston, but I've heard that Houston doesn't – actually, I have been to Houston, but not a whole lot. I heard that they don't have zoning laws, and so that there's – everything that you need is in your neighborhood. Your corner store, your gas pump, whatever else. But I don't know if that's totally true. I'd love to visit.
I've only been to Houston one time, and I was literally repainting a homeless mission in a barrio.
Yeah, well, we'll have to go visit and see if they have.
I can't imagine that Houston is a. I've never heard Houston set up as a bastion of the example of the new urbanism when you let city zoning go, but.
But I guess – so one thing I would advocate for is less draconian zoning so that there could be more mixture of use.
Right,
I really think that homeowners associations have to go. I'm hoping that they're destroyed someday legally, but we'll see.
There's two empty buildings within a block and a half of my house right now, and every time I drive by one, I'm like – man, would someone put a cafe in there?
Yeah.
Would someone put a bookstore?
There's probably not the right zoning.
Someone put something in where I could go buy some eggs and bacon to make my breakfast, find them out of them.
But then I think the other part is that the domestic architecture that we create and the neighborhoods that we make need to be human, meaning that they need to encourage social interaction,
right.
Walkability. Things like this, so that people this needs to come along with a cultural change where people need to move from living in private in a kind of isolated existence to living in public.
Right.
Right. And that's a cultural thing. I think that's something in our hearts, not something in the space. Right. Because you can live in a properly designed neighborhood and live a very private, isolated life.
No, there's no doubt. And you can also live in a neighborhood that's a total suburgatory.
Right.
And then but really be open and like have barbecues with your neighbors and stuff.
Exactly.
I mean, a good example. I mean, I always say I'm really all about independent coffee houses and stuff, and that's what I do for a living. But I worked at a Starbucks selling cafe inside of a Barnes & Noble, and with the intention, because it's the only place to get coffee in that town other than a gas station or a restaurant, and at that time. And we created real community in that corporate environment. Now, is that the perfect place? No. But you know what? People, you need to see the same people every day. It's funny. It's like people always think of like Cheers.
Sure.
Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name.
Right.
I saw something the other day that said, if there's a bar somewhere where everyone knows your name, you're probably an alcoholic. But there is that great moment. There's one of my favorite moments on Cheers is where Norm, who is kind of the guy that's there all the time, and then when he walks in, they all go, "Norm!" This guy leaves, and he looks over at Sam and Cliff and says, "Man, we really need to do something for that guy. We need to have an intervention or something. That guy sat here and drank with me for 13 hours yesterday. No, he's got a problem." And it's like, he's like, "But you were here too." It's like, he's like, "No, that guy's got an issue. He drank with me for 13 hours. We should have an intervention." You know? So but then the irony is that sometimes you want to go, let's look at the flip side of this to a certain extent. Sometimes, and I know I experience this, sometimes you want to go where nobody knows your name. Because I do coffee for a living, and I design and I'm part of the coffee community, I will purposely pick a shop sometimes. I want to go do the coffee house thing like a patron and just sit there and read and hang out and not do the coffee thing. But everyone knows me.
Yeah.
So it's like I have to go to some cafe I've never been to, act like I don't know what I'm doing, hunker down in the corner, put the headphones in or whatever, just to cafe experience.
And it's not to say, right, that there isn't an appropriate place for solitude, right? Of course there is. And that's a really important part of Catholic spirituality. It's a really important part of just being a human being, is having alone time sometimes.
Sometimes you need to be alone in a crowd, though, is the thing.
Okay, sure.
That's what those places are for.
But I do think that our society has tended to create those alone spaces a little bit too vigorously, which has led a lot of people to a place of isolation, a lack of community, a lack of connection, real connection with other human beings, whether it be in a religious environment or just in the neighborhood, you know?
And look at these houses. We're talking about the houses as a unit.
Sure.
Then we look inside the house, and this will lead into our next podcast about media and all that. But it's not like, oh, it's a box to watch TV in and everybody's in the same room watching the same four channels. No, they're all off in their own corners of the house with their own Netflix account and their own YouTube.
Right.
And it's isolation within house.
This is another problem.
It's atomization is what it is.
It is. It's an over-individualization of our architecture and our culture.
Right.
And I think one of the things that our generation wants to return to is some sort of public community, some sort of public life, public living, and a more humane and communitarian approach to family life.
Yeah.
Right, that isn't so atomized and isolated, where people feel, rather than being trapped in their own little room and their own little house and their own little car and their own little booth at the restaurant. You know, I think our generation wants to move toward eating together, living together, working together, playing together, that kind of stuff, where you're connecting with other human beings on a daily basis, and you're not living in your own little isolated, individualized universe.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
And I also think you're right that the barriers that we're talking about are built, but they can be overcome through a conscious decision.
Right.
You can choose to overcome the physical barriers that exist to create real community.
And when it comes to zoning and all this, it's like there's kind of, you got to find the sweet spot, right? Because you have one side, kind of like in Catholic social doctrine, you have this idea of like the political life being there to make it as easy as possible for men to live the good. But then on the other side, you've got what is it, T.S. Eliot, I think, in the Four Quartets, or maybe Eliot makes reference to or Choruses from the Rock, I think it was. It's a system so perfect that men won't have to be good.
Yeah,
right. And that's over zoning, over planning. It's like we're gonna. That's when you try to force people to live. You give them these tiny apartments, and then all this public space, and you try to force them into living in public.
Right.
And everyone ends up basically living in these little isolated pockets, and they're annoyed by everyone else who's trying to be isolated in the same space.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one other thing about urban planning in the Middle Ages, which you brought up way at the beginning, is that in the Middle Ages, at least the ideal city was planned in such a way that the cathedral was in the very middle.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, and then there were basically concentric circles of city space around the cathedral.
Right.
Which I think is just so beautiful to say that, you know, our spirituality is the core of who we are. And that's what all this activity that we're doing in the city is really all about. And it all begins there and goes back to there, you know.
You know, and I think a thing to look at we've kind of been down on planning, but with real intention, and I'll come back full circle to Fort Collins. We should do a story. We should do a podcast on this. We should look this up. But Fort Collins was a small agricultural community that was attached to a military fort. And I saw this on PBS in Fort Collins one day. It's fascinating, right? And I may get some facts wrong. So if anybody from Fort Phone is listening, you can correct me on Facebook. But from what I understand is that the railroad ended up going through someplace else, and they moved a military fort up to like Wyoming or whatever. And the question was, okay, we're just going to pack up and go with them? And they said, no, let's try to make a go of our own self-sustaining agriculture. And so they laid out this city, and they designed the city. And there's a map. It's like you can go look at it in Fort Collins in a museum. And they built these big wide roads, and the women used to gripe about them because you'd have to hold your dress up and they'd be muddy, and you'd get muddy walking across this big wide road. And they go, no, one day we're going to be a big town. and we're going to kind of want this for room. And they left a really, really big open space of prime farmland undeveloped. And they said, well, what's that for? Well, that's going to be a college. And they called if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that the documentary said they called that College Avenue. And if you've ever been to Fort Collins, all the streets run into College Avenue.
Huh.
Before there was a college there.
Huh.
And so they literally, it was kind of Field of Dreams. It was like, if you build
foresight,
it. And
yeah.
then they went and starved for, they had 2 years of like drought and famine, and it just didn't, nothing grew. And they, but they left this here. And sure enough, you go to modern Fort Collins and it works and looks exactly like that map from the 1800s.
Huh.
They literally, all the traffic patterns go to the college. Everything dumps you onto College Avenue, puts you towards the university. It's set up as a college town before there was a college there, with intention. So there's the other side of that planning.
Yeah, well, and there are some experimental urban planning communities, which are kind of interesting. So actually, Disney World made one in Florida. They built like a ideal urban plans neighborhood town type thing.
And downtown, I bet
Fort Ave Collins, Maria Town in Florida.
I bet Fort Collins was involved in that Disney thing because Downtown Disney in LA,
yeah.
is modeled after Downtown Fort Collins.
Interesting. So all those people are connected.
It just happened to be like a perfect little new urban thing to kind of copy.
The town of Ave Maria in Florida, right,
yeah.
which is a kind of experimental Catholic community, if you will, where they built a giant church in the middle of the town. The university's on one side of the church, and then the town's on the other side of the church. Kind of interesting. But the church is like in the middle of the whole thing.
I mean, what you put in the middle,
it means a lot. Yeah.
I think that tells you a lot about, I know the late president of Thomas Aquinas College, I asked him one time, I said, so why do we build this giant chapel? I mean, they built like one of the prettiest churches built in 80 years in America. I mean, it's an old school cruciform chapel, right? It's beautiful. And it costs just a ton of money. They've been fundraising it, designing it, and planning it for 30 years. It's like, why in the world did you do that? And he was like, so people that are okay with spending billions of dollars on a sports stadium and billions of dollars on giant temples to commerce that rise into the air would look at us and go, why would they spend all that money on something? It's almost like they thought it was important. He says, it's evangelism. He goes, we don't have a problem with a sports stadium. We don't have a problem with a big skyscraper for transacting business deals. Where you spend your money at, and that goes back to the Middle Ages, right? That big,
right.
that cathedral in the middle of that town was 100 times nicer and 100 times bigger than the average house in that village.
Yeah.
And they wanted it that way.
Well, we've talked about a lot of different aspects of urban planning.
Wow, this one was all over the place.
And there's a lot here, right? Because it ties into the way we live our everyday lives. And I think that we could revisit this topic at some point.
But I think that the next, then if we follow our plan, and the next one is about digital community versus association and all that, I think that the groundwork we've laid here and the questions we've raised will come together, and some payoff will happen in the next podcast. So.
Even though you're probably listening to this podcast on your back deck, you should really think about considering building a front porch that you can sit on to listen to the next episode of the podcast.
Go sit on the front porch on the stairs and drink a glass of wine and say hi to your neighbor when they walk by.
So you have finally reached the end of episode 9 of the Over the Counter podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.